The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Hi, I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson this afternoon. Always a pleasure to be able to do this for Mr. Monson. Before we get to The Big Lead, just a quick teaser. Going to be going over this letter that was sent to the mayor by the Seattle LGBTQAIPP Commission, and also getting into that crazy 60 Minutes interview that was leaked a few days early about President Donald Trump. Let's get to The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Big local.
So, Nicole, I always forget that that thing's coming up. I always forget that that's a two-parter. Hopefully I'll get it at some point in time in the future. But I will say this, Nicole. When you sent me this letter from the Seattle LGBTQ Council, when I received this, I thought, well, it's probably going to be a short letter. You would imagine that they would kind of be able to surmise their feelings about Mayor Jenny Durkan and how she's handled Chaz and Chop and the police. Could be pretty short. No, it's 6 pages long with citations. It is a college paper with the little citations at the bottom so that you know that they're citing this article and that article. And before we get into it, let me say this. I admittedly have I've poked fun at Mayor Durkan on occasion. I've been very critical of Mayor Durkan on occasion. I have said things that some people might say, well, hey, you know, that's a little below the belt. Admittedly, I'm happy to admit all these things. However, now I am going to find myself defending Mayor Durkan, which is a first for me, because this letter is absolutely ridiculous in almost every way, shape, and form. It begins, dear mayor and council members. Again, it's 6 pages long, so I've just decided to pick out the real meat of the issue. They establish themselves, and they say, this is who we are, and this is how we feel about things. But a line that caught me is they say, Mayor Durkan's resignation is necessary for Seattle to begin to address the human rights violations that have occurred in our city during her tenure. Human rights violations. So now she's a war criminal. She's like an African warlord who is committing human rights violations in a first world country in the richest nation in the world. That's fascinating to me because I didn't really see a whole lot of human rights violations. I can see there are some things that irritated me. There were some things that as a fellow citizen I saw during the riots and during the protests. I thought, well, that's not cool. I don't like it when people do that to my fellow citizens. But to call it a human rights violation, a little bit of strong language, a little bit of colory language to really drive the point home. They go on to say that while there has been a diversity of opinion within our commission, including but not limited to concern that taking such an action effectively ends engagement efforts, a majority of commissioners, 651, now join our community in calling for Mayor Durkan's resignation based on dereliction of duty and addressing harm caused in the following areas. And they go on to list several areas that they say Mayor Durkan has failed. One of the things I find troubling about this, though, is that they are speaking as if they represent everyone in the LGBTQ community. And I can tell you, as someone who has lots of friends who are in the LGBTQ community, not two of them think alike on any particular issue. And this is the problem inherently with these kinds of letters, just to begin with, that they are making these proclamations as if they speak for everyone, as if this is a universally held belief or idea regarding how Mayor Durkan has handled the recent upheaval in Seattle. They cite police accountability, which won't be a problem for long because they're all leaving. So they're all going to go somewhere else. So we don't even need to get into that, except for one section in particular. And this is what I mentioned before, in which I do agree with them. When they said in the letter, they write, SPD repeatedly used excessive force and chemical weapons against protesters, bystanders, members of the media, and more, including the use of tear gas and chemical crowd control agents. I agree with that to an extent. When I saw the footage, when I saw the video of certain groups of protesters getting hit with CS gas, it irritated me very much because I thought to myself, well, I'm not sure if I like that being used against my fellow citizens, especially if they're just kind of standing around and holding signs and yelling and so on and so forth. However, when you see the flipping over of cars and the attempted arson and the mortar rounds and the fireworks, yeah, no, then you've crossed the line, right? So what is Mayor Durkan supposed to do in that circumstance when you have people whose job it is to protect not only the people of the city, but also the property of the city? and you're telling them that they can't use the tools that are meant for exactly that instance, when someone is throwing fireworks and throwing Molotov cocktails and using lasers to try to blind people. This isn't conjecture, right? You can find all this data. Those are the things that were going on. So yeah, at a certain point in time, there has to be some kind of less lethal result to deal with that group of people. And if the protesters had just been out there, and if they had just had the signs and the chanting and the cheering, and I had seen CS gas being used, I would have been deeply upset. Like what happened at Lafayette Square, for example. I would have been very upset. How I just didn't see that, though. What I saw was fires and mayhem and rioting and looting. And so, yes, police need to do that at a certain point in time. So they're saying that they didn't want it used at all. No, it can't be. It shan't be used. We don't want it at all. Well, then what am I supposed to do if I'm a business owner in Seattle? What am I supposed to do if, let's say, I go to the protest and now my life is in danger and the police are over there, but they can't get to me because there's all these people? How are they supposed to function in that realm without the use of those tools? These people don't have an answer for that. Basically, their answer is we don't like it. And then they go on to say that it was Mayor Durkan's responsibility under Article 5, Section 2 to make herself the police chief and step in. And what does Mayor Durkan know about policing? No offense to Mayor Durkan. You had Chief Best. She knows policing. She did it for 30 years before they kicked her out. What could she possibly know about policing? What could she possibly know about riot control? So this whole letter is just one kind of, it could be surmised in one sentence. We don't like you. We just don't like you. But I don't know what Mayor Durkan could do, being the position that she's in, to appease this group of people, because she's everything that they already want. She's already very, very liberal. She herself is a lesbian. She's an open lesbian. She has all the credentials, all the bona fides that you would need to be in this particular group. But what they're saying is, we just don't like you. We don't like the way that you've tried to run your city. Mayor Durkan, on the other hand, she's saying, well, I'm running a city for everybody, not just one group of people. I'm running a city for an entire population. So I have to make some kind of concessions into the amount of force that I'm willing to use. They go on to cite houselessness in the article, and they say, which, by the way, the term houselessness, if I could say this, as a person who was homeless, don't take away my title. I was homeless for a number of years. I was not houselessness. I was homelessness. This kind of semantic overload that is attempted by the people in this letter is pretty ridiculous. They say Mayor Durkan has allowed encampment sweeps to continue by using broad language to designate encampments as obstructions. Well, I've seen footage. I watch Seattle is Dying. I've seen pictures. Those are obstructions. Yeah, no, they have to be moved. You're not allowed just to set up camp in the middle of a sidewalk. You can't do that. People, those are obstructions. Now you are obstructing the way, potentially causing harm and danger to other people. So what exactly would they possibly want from Mayor Durkan? Well, in the letter, they want her to basically be a dictator. They want her to be a despot. They want her to be total top-down control of everything that happens in the city of Seattle. Okay, she doesn't want to do that. So now apparently we have to get the person who wants to be that despot, who wants to be the king or the queen of Seattle. We need to inject them into that position of power, which is just completely unreasonable. So they end the letter by saying, it is with a heavy heart that we call for Mayor Durkan's resignation. Mayor Durkan is Seattle's first out lesbian mayor and only the second woman to hold that office. And in Jack Stein's humble opinion, you should just let her do that. And if you don't like her, you should vote her out when the time comes. This whole thing of we're calling on you to resign and all this kind of puffery is a tremendous waste of everybody's time. Tremendous. She says, they go on to say, we believe that the LGBTQ plus people and women, along with black people and others targeted by white supremacy, belong at all levels of local and federal government. So that's where it comes down to, right? Is it because she's a white woman? Is that what it is? It's awkward language. It's awkward for me to read that because they're not actually talking about what she's done over the course of her tenure. More so, they're just kind of segueing into this is a racial thing and this is a sexuality thing. And then sprinkled in the middle of that is, well, we don't like the way that you handle the police and we don't like the way that you handle homeless, so you need to go. Sorry, there's an election coming up. You get to deal with it then. So, yeah. Let's get to the national story.
The Big Lead, top trending.
So apparently Donald Trump, President Trump, is very upset because there was a 60-minute interview that was supposed to air on Sunday, and it broke online, and people have viewed it, and it is, Nicole and I were kind of talking about this off air a little bit, it is astounding the amount of resistance and friction that President Trump gets wherever he goes. To me, as an independent, as someone who looks at this and says, well, I don't have a dog in the fight, party speaking, not a Republican, not a Democrat. But when I look at what Trump has to go through in any interview form, in any setting, I can see how after 4 years, he's become a little bit rigid. He's become a little bit hackled. He's become a little bit irritated with how people treat him. I would get that way as well, especially when it's every single day, every single interview. I mean, how often does he really get a nice puff piece written about him, other than, you know, Hannity or Rush or any of those guys? How often does he get just someone sitting down with him and hashing it out one-on-one? I see more often than not, the guy runs up against a brick wall of bias. And as a president, yeah, you say that's the guy we're supposed to criticize the most. To this extent, though, it's now starting to get cringy. It's to use Nicole's term, it's starting to get awkward. So CBS News noted that the president appeared to be in a bad mood throughout the interview, but this official said the president was in a great mood prior to the interview and alleged that he was in a good mood following the interview.
Are you ready for some tough questions?
You're going to be fair.
I'm going to be fair.
Just be fair.
But last time I remember you saying to me, bring it on.
No, I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for fairness. That's all.
You may get fairness. But you're okay with some tough questions.
No, I'm not.
You're not okay with tough questions.
Well, I'm going to be fair. You don't ask Biden tough questions.
So interviewing 101, you never start it by saying, are you ready for some tough questions, my guy? You never, because that you're instantly putting somebody on the defensive. Even if you're joking, like you're at a frat party or something, you ready for some tough questions, my dude? That is just a horrible way to start an interview. And he handles it really well. President Trump says, yeah, I could pretty much handle it. And then it's all kind of downhill from there. There's an argument about begging women to like him.
You said the other day to suburban women, will you please like me, please?
Oh, I didn't say that. You know, that's so misleading. The way I say jokingly, suburban women, you should love me because I'm giving you security and I got rid of the worst regulation. See, the way you said that is why people think of you and everyone else is fake news. I said kiddingly, suburban women, you should love me. I got rid of a regulation that would bring low-income housing into suburbia that would destroy suburbia. And I said that in a joking way. The way you have it, it's like, oh, like I'm begging. I'm kidding. Play it, and I'm kidding. That is such a misleading question, Leslie.
But you're behind the suburban women in the polls.
I doubt it. I doubt it. I really doubt it. I'm saving suburbia. He's going to destroy suburbia. He's got a regulation, which I terminated, that he would put back, and even worse, that will bring low-income housing projects into suburbia.
There is probably nothing more infuriating, nothing more frustrating than saying something that is clearly a joke, saying something that is clearly meant to be funny or kind of maybe sardonic in some way. And then having someone say, well, so I guess to break it down like this, to put it in the most simplest terms, when someone says, so when you were talking about the chicken crossing the road, what kind of inference were you applying to that? I think Oscar Wilde said it best, is that when you dissect a joke, it's also kind of like dissecting a frog. it's got to die for the result of it. Trump handles that about as well, I think, as anybody could. Pretty polite about it. And then she kind of pushes him on it a little bit more. And he goes, hey, man, okay, at this point, you're asking me about a joke that I made about why suburban women should appreciate me. Here's my justification. This just goes on and on and on throughout the entire interview. And again, I get from all my very liberal friends who are listening right now, they say, well, that guy deserves it. That guy deserves every second of it. And for someone like me, I look at that and I go, oh, man, I just see the bias coming out of every single pore during that interview. I just see it. And it makes me distrustful of now 60 Minutes. Not that I was watching 60 Minutes, but it makes me now say, okay, so who am I supposed to go to now? Who am I supposed to go to now for some kind of reasonable reporting? They go on to argue about COVID cases are up, and interviewer asks him why he's calling people to get back to work. They also argue about mask wearing and rallies. They ask about ending Obamacare. I mean, the whole thing from start to finish was, again, just awkward. If you haven't seen it, I do recommend that you go see it. Someone posted it online, and it's easy to access.
Okay. Sorry, Jack. My computer, like, froze up there, but I can let me play this one. We're about to go to break. Let me play the one where they argue about him being aggressive, whereas, like, yeah. he brings up that they started it with her telling him she was going to be tough. So here you go.
I've been listening to you. I don't know how long we've been here, and it's just attack.
I don't think so. I mean, it's not attack.
It is.
It's defense against attacks.
No, you've been attacked.
It's defense against attacks.
You're very aggressive.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't view it that way. I'm defending myself, and I'm defending the institution of the presidency. Very important.
Can you?
Hi, Mike. Are you having a good time, Mike? Watching. You know Mike, right? Our great vice president.
I do.
You think she'd ask questions like this of?
Wow.
I don't think so. You think she'd ask questions like this of Joe? I don't think so.
He's exactly right. Would anybody ask questions like that of Joe Biden? Would anybody really hammer about that, or about the laptop, about his son, about Burisma, about all that money and where it was going? Is anybody going to ask? I would ask. I would ask, Nicole, get me in a room with Joe Biden. You give me 10 minutes with Joe Biden, I'll give you the greatest interview that's ever happened with a presidential candidate. I'll give you the greatest interview of all time.
Right. Well, that's the trick, is that he only allows people in the same vicinity of him that will ask about his ice cream flavors.
I will give Trump a ton of credit for never refusing an interview, even with people that just hate his guts. Woodward, Jonathan Swan. I mean, he just goes out there and he doesn't care. And sometimes it backfires, and sometimes he looks pretty bad. And then other times, like with Whitmer, you see this and you think to yourself, there's a lot of bias coming out on that side of the argument. Wish I could have probably had a better I wish they had conducted it in such a way where you actually got to hear him talk a little bit more about issues of substance, as opposed to constantly putting him on the defensive. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Going to take a quick break. When we get back, Mr. Chris Sullivan's going to come in, and he's going to explain what's going on with the... I hear you guys got a bridge problem going on there. Bit of a bridge issue. So Chris Sullivan is going to edify me. Take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. I begged and pleaded that we could have the world famous Chris Sullivan come in so that he could edify me, because Chris Sullivan, a man of many talents, but first and foremost, bridges. Could you possibly explain to me, like I'm a 5-year-old child, what exactly is going on with the West Seattle Bridge, and what exactly is going on with the just hundreds of millions of dollars that will go into potentially fixing this thing?
Okay, here's your 101 on the West Seattle Bridge, Jack. Basically, it's a bridge that connects West Seattle, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, neighborhood in the city of Seattle. But it's a peninsula, really, and so there really aren't a lot of good ways to get on and off the neighborhood. And the West Seattle Bridge connects them. And the bridge started cracking about a decade ago, and they started monitoring the cracking. And the cracking became so severe that in March of this year, they shut the bridge down. They just shut it down because they didn't think it was safe. And so 7 months now have passed without this bridge, without this lifeline to this huge neighborhood in Seattle. And they've been trying to figure out what to do over those 7 months. Can they try to repair the bridge? Should they repair the bridge, then get a new one, which they think they're going to have to do anyway? Or should they just go straight to repair? And they're pretty close to making that decision now on whether to replace or repair. And we're getting close, but yeah, it's been a big deal. And I mean, I try not to find silver linings in COVID because the whole situation is so nasty for so many people. But the fact that the traffic's been down 50% or more around the area has really actually helped West Seattle kind of get by. If this were regular traffic conditions, there would be no moving in and out of West Seattle because there are just so few ways to do it. Because you have the water on one side, then you have the Duwamish River on the other side, then you've got Boeing Field there before you get to I-5. You've got a couple of small neighborhoods here and there, and it's not designed to handle the 100,000 or so trips across that bridge that used to take every day.
And I would imagine on top of that, you know, silver linings of COVID-19 and all that, that it potentially this now maybe gave them even more of an opportunity to assess what exactly needs to be done. I'm looking at, so you wrote a piece about does Seattle have the will to fast track potential West Seattle bridge replacement? It's on mynorthwest.com. My understanding is that there's a gentleman, his name is Tom Zoli. And he's got an idea. Ted, thank you very much.
Ted Zoli, yep.
And he's got an idea for a potential replacement. It's a twin steel span bridge. It's about 40% lighter than concrete, can last up to 100 years. He has done this before in the great state of New York, and he says that he could do it here. Tell me why that you think this is the way to go.
Well, I mean, and again, I try not to take sides, but this seems like a really good option because let's face it, the number one thing in this whole process is trying to find that capacity again to give West Seattle a way to get in and out of its community, and you want to do it safely. So speed and safety are usually kind of mutually exclusive. It's hard to do them together, right? Especially when it comes to building a bridge. And remember last week when we talked about the $30 car tab thing, how there's kind of a process in Seattle where we get an initiative passes or fails, and then somebody sues, and that's just the way we do things. It's kind of similar here when it comes to mega projects or big projects like this. There's something called the Seattle process, and we don't say that in a kind way. Because the way the city works is they get committees and blue ribbon panels, and they think and they think and they think and they talk and they talk and they talk. And then next thing you know, they haven't really decided anything. And the concern here is, can the city of Seattle fast track something which goes against that ethos that this community has become known for? And the reason I say that is, and I don't want to undercut the fact that environmental regulations are important. They're very important. They're vital to this region. We have so many things to protect there in the environment. So the environmental issues are dear to the hearts of people in the Pacific Northwest. But a lot of people say those environmental regulations and permits take way too long and postpone and add money to projects like this. And when you're in an emergency situation like this, can there be a way to fast track all of that permitting? Because what Ted Zoli did in Lake Champlain, he did 5 years worth of environmental work to replace a bridge between New York and Vermont. He did it in 6 weeks because everybody got on board, realized there was an emergency here, and they kind of streamlined the effort. And in order for his idea, which I'll get to just in a moment, is to happen, we're going to have to find a way to streamline that environmental process in this city, which really likes taking a long time with its process. But anyway, his bridge is kind of unique. Well, not necessarily. It's something that we don't do a lot here on the West Coast. The West Coast was we're a concrete bridge builder. We do a lot of concrete box girders, things like that. This would be a steel frame bridge. And one of the reasons we don't use steel is because of the weather. I mean, the corroding and the painting and all that kind of stuff factors in. Concrete has a little less cost to a little less environmental damage, whatever, breaking down. So his span, he would build it in one location while he was taking down the existing structure over the Duwamish River. So they would have multiple fast-track parallel things. And so while one is happening, the other is going on. And then they take down the center section. They use the existing piers and supports of the West Seattle Bridge, which keeps them out of the water, the Duwamish River, which also could get rid of some environmental permitting issues. And then they float the spans in over the Duwamish and then lift them into place. So it's, and he can do it, he says, in about 3 years, which is about the time that they would estimate that the repair option would take, plus give them so much more life to the bridge. It really looks like a very intriguing idea. Now, it hasn't been vetted fully. They haven't gone through the process of finding out if this meets all the things that has to happen. But it is very intriguing, and it's got a lot of people in West Seattle really kind of pumped up, like, wow, this sounds really good. Is it too good to be true?
I got a prediction, Chris Sullivan. What's going to happen is that someone's going to find out that there's a rare jay, a rare blue jay, that feeds on a rare salamander that's only found in that particular part of the sound. And thus, we need to scrap the whole plan. We need to figure out what we're going to do because the animals are very important. And that's going to be my prediction. It's going to get locked up for the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, we hope that's, and that's kind of the idea, is we hope that that doesn't happen. Even members of this task force that met yesterday for about 3 hours, they've been meeting throughout the summer. Their job is to kind of help guide and advise Mayor Durkin on whether she should go to replace or repair first and foremost. And so they were even concerned. They're like, man, when we hear streamlining EIS and environmental stuff, all my lawsuit bells and alarms start going off, because that's what happens here. I mean, that's what Seattle and the Pacific Northwest has become known for. That's the way we do business. I told you it. It's the way it happens here, not like California. Yeah. And so we're hoping I'm speaking kind of for the folks that I heard yesterday in the task force, like, boy, if we could find a way to get on track, get everybody, even the people who might file a lawsuit for X, Y, or Z, we all have the arrow pointing the same direction. We could get this done, because the greater good is protecting that neighborhood over there, which is seeing property values drop, people moving out, businesses going under, because not only do they have to deal with the pandemic, but no one can get to and from their places because the bridge is closed. And so it's been very difficult for them. And the idea is, this is an idea that if it pencils out and passes all the scrutiny, if the city can get through the environmental process quickly, we could really help out this community that really needs it.
Chris Sullivan, you're a gentleman and a scholar. I appreciate you coming on the show very much. You're listening to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. When we get back, the Seattle Storm has decided to endorse presidential candidate for the first time in its history. You will not, well, maybe 50% of you will be right, 50% of you will be wrong, but you will not believe how shocking this is. Take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Take opportunity, check out my YouTube channel, Human Genius, two words, easy to find. You get to see my beautiful face. You get to see what I do when I'm not doing this, which is my YouTube channel, which I'm really quite very proud of. I do basically the same thing that I do there, that I do here, except for there's audio and video and all that other kind of fun stuff. The Seattle Storm endorses who? For president. So I got my ballot in the mail about a week ago, and I did not, I had registered to vote unintentionally. I wasn't actually planning on voting this year. And I went to do some volunteer work for the city that I live in, and they make you register to vote when you volunteer. And so I say, okay, well, I get my ballot and I crack it open and I say, well, this should be really interesting. And I'm looking at all the names as to, you know, presidential and local and federal. And I go, I don't know any of these people. What's wrong with my ballot? And then I realize that it's not ordered by, you know, it doesn't start with Kamala Harris, Joe Biden. It doesn't start with Donald Trump, Mike Pence. It starts with like the Libertarian Party and then the Green Party and then this party and then the American. And then finally I got to some names that I recognized. So this year I will be voting for Kanye West. So my point is that I wouldn't tell anybody who I was voting for. I'm not that kind of guy. I keep it private. That's a decision that I make for myself. I don't feel the need to make a video or to make some proclamation or tweet or Facebook post that says, this year is the most important election of our years and I will be voting for so-and-so. Why? Because I've heard it for years that this election is the most important election of our lifetime. I have heard it for years. People told me when it was Bush-Kerry, that was apparently the most important election of my lifetime. Obama, McCain, most important election of your lifetime. It just seems to continue to go on and on and on to the point where I no longer believe it. It is now the sky is falling and I no longer believe it. So the Seattle Storm has decided to endorse Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Surprise of surprises. And what is their reasoning for letting everybody know this? They say it is not typical times. In a move rarely seen by professional sports teams. That's a lie. Sports teams do this stuff all the time. The Seattle Storm voiced its support to the 2020 Democratic ticket of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris on Wednesday. They tweeted it out so everybody could know that that's where they stood on that position. And I find myself saying, okay, well, it's America. You can do what you want. But shouldn't there be a certain amount of kind of, I would use the word decorum. A certain amount of, I don't know, a certain amount of just, well, this is a private decision that I make. I don't feel the need to broadcast it to everybody out there that this is how I really feel. Now, some people already do that. Some people already wear hats. Maybe you've seen them. They say, make America great again. Pretty sure I know who that person's going to vote for. Some people put it in front of their homes. Say, this is a Biden sign. This is a person I'm going to vote for. But I don't see the need for teams or companies or even celebrities for that matter to constantly remind us of their presence by saying, oh, by the way, I'm important too. I'm going to vote. It's like, great, good for you. Yeah, go out and do that. I'm still not going to go to your games. I'm still not going to go. But it doesn't matter to me who you are picking to vote for. And in addition to that, the very man that they are, the very individual that they will be voting for. Nicole, did you hear about this, about the Biden campaign taking down an ad of a wealthy Democratic donor posing as a struggling small business owner? I found this just to be.
I don't know if we have the, let me just start it. I'll stop it because we don't have time to play the whole thing, but here's a little bit of that ad.
Everywhere I go, people have a story about the Blind Pig. The Blind Pig has been one of those clubs that attract artists from all genres. For 50 years, the Blind Pig has been open and crowded, but right now it's an empty room. This is the reality of Trump's COVID response.
Anyway, then it goes on to say that, you know, because Trump shut them down, you know, he may not survive it, and the bar may have to shut for good and all that. And we talked about it a little bit yesterday, but now Biden campaign has taken down the ad.
Turns out he's actually got tons and tons of money. So that's why I had to take out the ad. The guy was totally lying. Hey, I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. We got to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be getting into the Fastest 15. Lots of people coming out. Lots of people talking about who they're going to be voting for in the Fastest 15. Take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.